Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell has done much to bring the findings of social science into the public conversation, starting with The Tipping Point, which examined the crucial moment a disease, trend, or phenomenon explodes. Gladwell's new book is called Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. And in it, he dives into the unconscious forces rippling under some of the most high-profile disasters between people who didn't know each other, like Brock Turner, Sandra Bland, even Adolf Hitler. It's an ambitious project, and Malcolm Gladwell joins us in our studio to discuss. Malcolm Gladwell, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what sparked the idea of this book for you?
Well, it really began with the Sandra Bland incident, which was one of that string of high profile encounters between African Americans and law enforcement. And it was a young woman is pulled over by the side of the road in a small town in Texas, a young black woman, and gets into a conversation with a police officer, which quickly turns contentious. She's arrested, and then she hangs herself 3 days later in her cell. And we have the officer's desk cam captured the entire exchange between the two of them. And I just at the time remember reading that, and I couldn't get out of it was so heartbreaking and so revealing and so many things that I found myself kind of obsessed with the case and wanted to write a book using that case as an example of what I think of as a very modern problem, which is people of different backgrounds or different worlds being incapable of communicating effectively.
So there's so much to talk about in the Sandra Bland example, and we'll do that in a little bit, but I kind of want to lay out some first principles first. So let's start with, what is a stranger? I mean, this concept of a stranger is core to the book. So how do we define what a stranger is?
Anyone with whom you have limited experience. So if you look at evolution for, years and years and years and years, we spend almost all of our time with immediate family, relatives, members of the same clan. They were not strangers to us. We rarely met strangers. But in the modern world, the encounters we have on a day-to-day basis are largely with people outside of our circle of intimates. And that's what I'm just using strangers as a catch-all for non-family and friends.
Okay. And, again, we'll go deep into Sandra Bland later, but even now for this question, a lot of frames one could choose to process that case and many of the other cases in the book. What was the thing where the stranger frame was the thing that came forward for you versus a race frame or a gender frame or a power dynamics frame or any of a number of other frames?
Well, all of those frames that strike me, power, race, all those kinds of things, are subsets of this stranger frame.
So you think this is the superset?
I think this is the appropriate way to... I mean, the way I think about it is, imagine that Sandra Bland had been, she was from Chicago, and there she was in small town Texas. She'd just actually driven down the day before.
For a job interview.
Imagine if she was from that town. She was the same age as the officer who pulled her over, Brian Insignia. So it's quite conceivable it could have gone to the same high school. That encounter still has a racial dimension and still has a power dimension, but now they're familiar with each other. And now the first word out of the officer's mouth is, "Sandy, I saw you didn't signal your lane change. I just wanted to tell you, please do that next time." Literally, it's over. I mean, and all of us, any of us who grew up in small towns, as I did, had those encounters with law enforcement, right? Where we knew either knew the officer outside of his role as an officer, or we knew his family, or we knew his kids, or we went, I in my little town where I grew up, that was the case. I was friends with the chief of police's son. I mean, it was, so there's multiple points because the officer was not a stranger. There was multiple ways for us to get around the fact that he had a gun and I didn't. He was powerful and I wasn't. Or in the case of Sandra Bland, the officer was white and she was black. They would have had a way to negotiate their differences. But when people are unknown to each other, that opportunity doesn't present itself.
So what's playing in the back of my head as I'm listening to you? So I grew up in a relatively small community as well. In fact, once in high school, I got pulled over driving, and the police officer was like, oh, your mom sold me my house.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly what happened to me. Yeah.
But I could actually imagine a circumstance where they did go to high school together. They are the same age. He pulls her over and he doesn't say, Sandy, you didn't turn on your blinker. He says exactly what he did say.
Yeah.
And there could be a number of factors. Race, it's just so hard to escape the race frame on this. And mm-hmm. I was so uncomfortable with you setting it aside. And I wanted to ask you
about that. So it's interesting. I thought a lot about this. I absolutely think that race is a major factor in that encounter. It's one of the big reasons why he stops her in the first place. If she's a 75-year-old white lady in a Mercedes, he's not pulling her over, right? There's no question about that. But I became very frustrated with the way in which race is used in our society as an explanation that ends the discussion and that allows us to walk away and not. So the simplest way to see the Sandra Bland case is to say, oh, not a racist cop. What are you going to do, right? We say that every time, and nothing ever happens. I mean, the thing that inspired this book was a book I read by a criminologist named Frank Zimmering, pointing out that 1,000 people are killed by law enforcement in America every year, a number way out of whack with every other country in the world. And this has been going on for years. So we have a problem, an intractable problem, that we have been utterly incapable of dealing with. And I wonder whether one of the reasons is that we use the race frame as a very convenient way to wash our hands and walk away. And what I was determined to do in this book was to give us an explanation that not only forbade us from walking away, but also gave us a way of addressing the problem. And so that's why the last quarter of the book is a in-depth examination of law enforcement strategies that I think contributed directly to this fateful encounter. So I am putting that question aside for productive reasons, not because I think it's an irrelevant consideration.
All right, so that's helpful. So mm-hmm. you keep people at the table. You do this framing of strangers and our default positions and how we encounter strangers, what we assume about ourselves, our ability to read them, what we assume about them mm-hmm. and what they're projecting to us. So now, once you've set that up and people can understand that, let's say in the Brian mm-hmm. and Cindy and Sandra Bland case, put race back into the framework. How do we then resituate the question of race and policing, for example, mm-hmm. back into this superset? You've said it's the superset. That frames, put it back in. How do we, help me understand how that fits together.
Well, that's the project of the last two chapters of the book. When I'm talking about what is the role of proactive, that's a nice word, but what is the role of proactive policing in our society?
And you describe that in some detail using the Kansas City model as an example.
There was a great paradigm shift in urban policing in America in the last generation, where police went from being reactive to proactive.
That happened here in Boston, done differently.
Yeah.
But the Boston Miracle was a concentrated place and gang-based set of interventions combined with community organizations in the same way.
Yeah. And my argument is that many, not all, but many of the issues that we have, particularly between law enforcement and communities of color, have to do with the misapplication and misuse of that notion of proactive policing. So in a way, that is explicitly, that argument in that book, it's explicitly about race. It just so happens I don't frame it that way, but I think it's clear to any thoughtful reader that that's what I'm getting at, that I'm saying that for reasons that have nothing to do with effective policing, we have taken a tactic that might be appropriate in a very small number of neighborhoods in urban areas and applied it willy-nilly to places where it does not belong.
Broadly.
And, you know, there is another book to write about why we did that and it just so happens that's not...
That's not the book you wrote.
There's not a point. There's a point where you have to say, okay, I've written 100,000 words. I should probably stop now. But there is no way a single book can address the complexities of this issue. I wanted just to focus in on the extent to which Brian Insinia takes an already difficult and problematic encounter and renders it catastrophic by means of his, A, complete inability to understand who he's talking to, and B, his overconfidence in his ability to make sense of a stranger. That's really the core of this, is that he honestly believes he can come to a conclusion about Sandra Bland in 30 seconds. And I wanted the project of this book is to tell us to slow down and to ratchet back our self-confidence and understand that people are not transparent in that way.
You know, in my classes, I have taught a speech you gave years ago on Amadou Diallo and the shooting. And you talk about sort of rapid association of race and danger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought in the Brian Encinia case, you talk about all the people he pulled over before he pulled over Sandra Bland.
Yeah, yeah.
And it made me think of, okay, so it's like 15 in like a 25-minute period. It's incredible.
Crazy. Yeah.
And none of them wound up pulled out of their car, you know. And I found myself thinking about
you raise a really interesting point. So we have the Texas Highway Patrol has... anyone can access it, a complete record of every traffic stop made by Brian Encinia during his entire career as a police officer. We have focused on the last stop he made, which was Sandra Bland, and before he got suspended from the force. We don't know how many of those previous ones were problematic, right? I would suspect, so there are many ways it can be problematic. And one of the points of the book is that many of those were in all likelihood problematic because they all fit the same pattern. They were him coming up with an extraordinarily trivial reason for pulling someone over on the very, very, very slight chance that they might be engaged in some kind of more serious criminal activity.
It's a fishing expedition.
Fishing. And my contention is that every time you do that, go on a fishing expedition and come up empty, you do serious damage to the social fabric of our country. So I would argue that, and by the way, he almost never found anything. The story of his career as a police officer is that he harassed dozens and dozens and dozens of innocent civilians and found almost nothing. He had like once found a gun, once he got somebody for, but it's incredible how many times he came up empty. I would argue every single one of them was problematic, not in as florid a way as the Sandra Bland case, but each of them had the effect of undermining the legitimacy of policing and of furthering the kind of isolation of minority communities from general society.
All right. So I promised myself I'd leave us just a little bit of time for a couple questions about the Brock Turner case, mm-hmm. which was a college alcohol and rape case.
Yeah.
And there were two things that I wanted to ask you. I get the luxury of asking you questions after I read the book.
Yeah.
The first was I was thinking about our beliefs about certain types of strangers going in. How do they affect us? And here's my point. When I was Emily Doe's age, the generic name of the victim, when I was her age, I didn't trust young men. I didn't default to truth. I defaulted to, I am alone, I may be in danger. Mm-hmm. So our going in position about a type of stranger, how does that affect the dynamic that you talk about in the book?
I think it has a huge impact on it. And one of the things I wanted to do with that chapter was, I think there is insufficient... maybe urgency is the wrong word, about the problem of sexual... You would think reading the news, and many people say, oh, we're constantly talking about sexual assault on campus. If you look at the actual statistics compiled by the NIH on sexual assault on campus and also on the consequences of alcoholism on campus, they are mind-blowing. The numbers are... an order of magnitude higher than you would imagine. If we actually were rational about this, we would be up in arms about this problem. Given the dimensions of that, it is entirely appropriate for particularly young women who are the most victimized party to enter a drunken frat party with a great deal of trepidation, right?
Which is a deeply disturbing concept.
It is a deeply, but it is, there is no other, I think, rational explanation when you look at the level of risk here. And I think what's happened is that we have all gotten a little blasé about what it means to combine young men and their hormones and excessive amounts of alcohol.
And do you excuse Brock Turner for his decisions based on these faulty...
To the contrary. I think one of the things we have to be absolutely clear about when we talk to young people today is that if you abuse alcohol, you are dramatically increasing your risk of committing a criminal act, right? That there is this notion, when you look at the way young people drink now, and the way they drink now, by the way, has nothing in common with the way people drank when you and I were in college. There is a note, we have come to this weird position with that generation, where they think of getting drunk as something, as a kind of harmless lark, and getting blackout drunk as something that you can do routinely without consequences. Neither of those positions are true. They are deeply naive positions.
And I'm sorry, we are actually out of time, which is a heartbreak. I would love to keep talking to you. Malcolm Gladwell is a New Yorker staff writer and a best-selling author. He'll be speaking at the Back Bay Event Center tonight at 7:30. Thank you for being here.
Good. Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.